Great. Well, thanks everybody for the invitation and the warm welcome to Perimeter. So I'll talk about some work that I started to do when I got to Stony Brook on dark matter direct detection, and has been this continuing effort. So this is primary work with Reuven Essig and Tomer Volansky, and also with Jeremy Martin when he was still doing this stuff. So the basic idea is to look for new ways to look for dark matter, in particular light dark matter, through dark matter electron scattering in direct detection experiments. So just as to make sure everybody is on board, the way that dark matter direct detection works is you have some target material that you put deep underground, that has atoms in it. And the idea is, like, we're in this dark matter halo, we're surrounded by dark matter that's passing through us, and you assume that this dark matter can interact somehow with the atom. And that in these experiments, then the dark matter scatters off of the atom, this atom recoils, and you detect that recoil. And so this has led to, this is an idea that's been around for a few decades, and it's led to this very kind of well-developed, clear program that's been pursued for the last few decades. In particular, what people have been thinking about is dark matter scattering off of the nuclei in these experiments. And so what I'm showing here is the current parameter space for dark matter nucleon scattering. So on the y-axis, on this axis, is the WIMP nucleon cross-section in centimeters squared, converted to picobarns over here. And on the x-axis is the mass of the WIMP in GeV. Right? So these are in terms of the WIMP, because theoretically, the WIMP has been this very dominant paradigm in dark matter. So a lot of effort has been going on to look for WIMPs. So this goes from about 1 GeV to 10 TeV. So in the blue region, which is labeled lux, this is, I think there's one new bound that's slightly stronger than this, but it's roughly around the same place. So this is the current constraint on dark matter nucleon scattering from the lux experiment, which is a liquid xenon detector. And what this is saying is that if there were a dark matter nucleon cross-section above this line, lux would have seen it. And because they don't see an excess of events, this constrains the size of the cross-sections for masses above 10 GeV. And then the black line is a projection for LZ, which is a future liquid xenon detector. I think it's going to be a couple tons of liquid xenon. It's very large. So this will have a reach down to these cross sections. So if they don't see anything, they'll rule out all the parameter space up here. And the green line is a projection from Super CDMS Snow Lab, which is a semiconductor experiment. And they have a comparable reach, but they can go down to 400 MeV. So this line stops at about 400 MeV. And then this pink region is something called the neutrino background. So this is sort of the irreducible background where you wouldn't be able to differentiate between a neutrino scattering and a dark matter scattering. So this is sort of like the lower limit that you would reach. So this is what some people call the neutrino floor. And you see here that lux, and especially LZ and the super CDMS, are getting very close to the neutrino background, especially in this region. And so we're really covering a lot of this interesting WIMP parameter space, and so far with no evidence. But then the question is, well, all of these curves stop at some point. What if dark matter was not your stereotypical WIMP, it was not a few hundred GeV? What if it was slightly lighter, say 100 MeV? The question is, how would you be able to detect this dark matter? And so the reason, to start thinking about how you'd be able to detect lighter dark matter, you have to understand why these curves curve up they do. So you see that lux loses sensitivity about 10 GeV. LZ, similarly, it can't see dark matter lighter than a few GeV. And Super CDMS Snow Lab can only see dark matter down to 400 MeV. So the point here is, if your dark matter is 100 MeV, all of these experiments would be invisible. It would be invisible in all of these experiments. You would never be able to detect it. So why is that? So the answer is basic kinematics. Okay, so when you have a dark matter scattering off of a nucleus, it goes like this. The recoil energy that you have available to detect goes like the momentum transfer squared divided by the nucleon mass. And so this scales roughly like 50 keV times the mass times the nucleus mass. So let's put in some numbers. And then this recoil energy you would then detect through phonons, photons or electrons. So this is what you actually see in your detector. So the more recoil energy you have, the larger the signal you have. So for, let's take silicon as our target material. So it has a nucleon mass of 28 GeV and a typical WIMP mass of 100 GeV. Then you would have a recoil energy of 100 kV. So this is a good amount of energy available. But what if we go down to 100 MeV? So now our dark matter has gotten much smaller. The amount of recoil energy you have is now less than an EV. So you've gone down four orders in magnitude of available energy to detect. So this is the reason why these dark matter nuclear scattering experiments can't access these low masses, just because you don't have enough recoil energy to see. And just to put some numbers, the thresholds of a lot of these experiments, the lowest thresholds for these experiments is around 50, 60 EV, which means that they require at least 50, 60 electron volts to have a signal. Okay, so this is not great, because what if dark matter is 100 MeV? We want to be able to find it. So how do we get around this? Well, you can make the observation that in an atom, we have the big nucleus, but we also have a small electron, or many electrons. And so instead of looking at the dark matter scattering off of the nucleus, we can consider a dark matter scattering off of the electrons. And here, the signal would be a few ionized electrons. So you would see the electron itself that you scattered off of. And the recoil energy here scales roughly like half an EV times the mass of the dark matter, now an MeV. Okay? So if I go back to the same scenario where I have a silicon atom and 100 MeV dark matter, I now have about 50 EV in recoil energy available. So this is getting close to what the thresholds of experiments are. And we've gained 500 times more energy to detect. Okay, so now I'll talk a little bit about what goes into calculating the rate of dark matter electron scattering. So there's a few ingredients with the rate. So what I'm showing here is the differential cross-section as a function of the recoil energy of dark matter electron scattering. So the first ingredient is this thing in the blue box, eta Vmin, and this encodes the astrophysics that's in this process. So this tells you of how the dark matter is distributed in our galaxy. In particular, eta Vmin is the velocity distribution of the dark matter, which I take to be a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So this tells you how the velocity is distributed in the halo. And this depends on a quantity called Vmin, which is the minimum velocity your dark matter needs to have a scattering. So for a fixed dark matter mass and a fixed energy deposition, what is the minimum, or what is the momentum that dark matter needs to have to scatter? The second ingredient is what I call sigma E bar and FDM. So this is where the particle physics lives. This is where the interaction between your dark matter and electrons is encoded. And so the sigma E bar is a reference cross-section for dark matter electron scattering, where I take the free scattering matrix element, and I set the momentum to be alpha ME, which is the typical momentum transfer in these processes. And then I can pull out all of the momentum dependence in the scattering into a form factor, which I call FDM. So as an example, if I have a heavy mediator that mediates the dark matter electron scattering, then this is a momentum independent process, and FDM equals 1. Whereas if I have an ultra light mediator, then this the momentum dependence goes like 1 over Q squared. So you can sort of categorize in a fairly model independent way the scatterings in terms of the momentum dependence. So I don't have to specify a model outside of how how the cross section depends with momentum.
And this Q squared equals alpha squared ME, that's ME squared, that's particular to these sorts of electron scattering.
That's the typical momentum for electron scattering.
Right, and that's because that's the electron's momentum.
Yes, in the atom. You can pick, I think some of these other groups who have looked at this, they pick a slightly different reference momentum. For us, this was a logical choice. Okay, and the final ingredient is the small form factor, little f, which is a material-dependent quantity. So this is where the direct detection comes in. And what this little f tells you is, what it is actually, is the wave function overlap between the initial and final electron states. So effectively, this tells you how likely it is from an electron in state I to transition to a state I prime. So with these three ingredients, we can wrap them all up. You can integrate over all possible energy, recoil energy. So this is where the threshold comes in. multiply it by the local dark matter density divided by the mass, and then multiply it by the number of target nuclei per unit mass. And then you end up with the rate, which is the number of scattering events you would see per unit mass per unit time. Okay, so for the first example I'm going to talk about is scattering in a noble liquid, in particular in liquid xenon. So the form factor here is a slightly complicated expression. But effectively, the point here is the electron wave functions, which is this thing that goes into the form factor, can be calculated with Hartree-Fock methods for atoms. So here you're just saying that I have an individual atom, and you can, these are well known, the wave functions in these materials, and so you can look them up in tables and calculate the form factor, which, so these wave functions here, and the angular momentum things. And in this way, you get the form factor. And so for xenon, what I'm showing here on the right-hand side is a picture of a xenon atom where I have all the electrons in their orbitals. And the electron configuration of xenon is like this, where the outermost electrons are the 5p shell, and then you have the 5s shell, so these are the ones out here, and then 4d, 4p, and 4s. You can, I mean, there's more electrons, but for the kind of scattering momentum transfer that we're looking at, you would never access the further in electrons. So we stop at 4s. So on the left-hand side, I'm showing the number of events you would expect for 1,000 kilogram years in a xenon detector as a function of the number of electrons that you observe. So you can convert the recoil energy into the number of electrons, which I've done in this figure. And the different lines are showing you the contributions to this number of events from all the different electron shells. So you can see at low energies or low number of electrons, it's the 5p shell that dominates. And then this drops off very quickly. And this is because the 5p shell has the smallest ionization energy. And then as you go deeper and deeper in, then these other shells start to come in. So naively, you would expect these to just drop monotonically, but because you start to access these innermost shells, you have some features in the spectrum. Okay, so now I have this spectrum, I have this predicted number of events. What can I do with it? The black line is the total rate, and I'm not sure if you can see it very well. There's a gray shaded region here, and this is the uncertainty from the secondary ionization modeling. So when I explained earlier, you have dark matter scattering off of an electron in the atom, and you detect that one electron. If that electron has enough energy, it will ionize other secondary electrons. And this is how you get this spectrum. So you have your initial electron that you ionize, and then if it's energetic enough, it'll ionize other things. And this modeling is not completely known, so we characterize that uncertainty in this gray band. Okay, so now I have this theoretical prediction for the number of scattering events that I would expect to see in xenon. So now we can compare with experiment. We can try to set some limits. And so here's a picture of a xenon detector, a time projection chamber, where experiments that are like this are xenon 10, 100, 110, and lux. So the way that these experiments are set up is they have this tank of liquid xenon, which is this like darker blue region, that has a layer of gaseous xenon on top. So this is this region right here. And then on both ends, we have photomultiplier tubes. And so for a typical WIMP, what happens is you scatter in the liquid, you scatter off of nucleus in the liquid xenon case, and this produces a scintillation photon, and you detect that photon. This is called an S1 signal. Whereas the background for WIMP cases are just electrons that float up that create photoelectrons, and then you detect those. So that's a S2 signal. So in these WIMP searches, what they look at is the ratio of S1 and S2. So the dark matter signal would have a S1 over S2, very, very big, because the S1 should be large, whereas the background will have that ratio be very small, because you have more S2. For dark matter electron scattering, we're looking at an S2-only signal. We don't have any associated S1 with it. And so this would require a dedicated analysis from these experiments. And the point here is we scatter off the electron floats up, and it creates photoelectrons. So what they actually measure is number of photoelectrons.
So I didn't get why S2 is a background.
As to for the WIMPs, it's a background. Because the WIMP wouldn't scatter off of the electrons. Whereas the background could be these electrons that get created. But for our case, we're looking at this S2 only signal. So then you can say, but if the S2 is the background, how do you differentiate? The point here is that the background electrons that you create are usually at much, much higher energies than what we're interested in.
The background ones, are those just because of like detector effects because you're in really high electric?
Or like Compton scattering, neutrons, stuff like that. Yeah, I don't think I have a slide about this. There's a background for us that comes with the fact that it's a two-phase detector. Maybe I'll mention this later. Okay, the point here is that these experiments, if they do a dedicated S2 only analysis, they can start to constrain dark matter electron scattering. And so Xenon 10 had a dedicated S2 only analysis that they did in 2013. This is kind of a busy plot. So the right-hand side is their data, which you can then plot in terms of the number of events versus photoelectrons, which I'm showing on the left-hand side. So the data from Xenon 10 is in these yellow bars. And I've overlaid on top of them two example spectrum from dark matter. So if my dark matter were 10 MeV, it would look like this blue shaded region. Whereas if it was 1 GeV, it would look like this red shaded region. So the features here that are interesting is that when you have a light dark matter, it really populates the low photoelectron bins. So, and for xenon, 27 photoelectrons equals one electron. So on the top axis, I've labeled in terms of number of electrons. You can see that for a low dark, like 10 MeV dark matter, it really populates the one electron bin and then dies off very rapidly. Whereas the 1 GeV dark matter populates more of the electron bins.
So both of these, you use the electron scattering.
Yeah.
The S2 only.
Yes, this is the S2 only data from Xenon 10. Okay. And so with this, you can then constrain the cross section, because here I've set the cross section to be to map to the limit that I set. The point here is you want the number of events that you predict to be less than the observed number of events. And by doing this, then you can have limits on your sigma E bar plane. Now I'm showing sigma E bar versus dark matter mass. But you'll see here that the dark matter mass is now in MeV, whereas in the previous plot, it was in GeV. So I've gone down three orders of magnitude. It's basically the same shapes, but just scooted down. So these are a bit busy, so I'll talk through what all these different colors are. So the ultimate limit is in this thick black line. So this is the limit on the sigma E bar, this dark matter electron scattering cross section, as a function of dark matter mass for two different form factors. So on the left-hand side is the FDM equals to 1. So this is if you have a heavy mediator mediating the interaction. On the right-hand side is the 1 over Q squared. So this is if you have a very light mediator mediating your interaction. The different colored bands are the contributions from the different number of electrons or the number of photoelectron bins. So I was saying when you're at low mass at 10 MeV, it was the first electron bin that set the limit. So here, that's this line right here. So you see that's where you get the strongest limit. Whereas if you go down to up to 1 GeV, then it was the higher bins that set the limit. So here, it's this one. So it's this high photoelectron bin that sets the limit.
When you guys are setting these limits, are you just taking their measured background level and saying, you know, if dark matter created that, what would be the cross section?
Yeah, so it's this very conservative thing. We're saying if all the events that they saw were signal, what's the cross section? So if you have a background model, then these would go down. Because then you're saying, not all the events are from dark matter. There's some that are background. But for this, we assume that all events are from our signal.
Okay. How sensitive are yourselves to the modeling of the FDM form factor?
So that's what these two plots show. So then I'll explain on the second side. It's the same, it's basically the same thing where the thick black line is the limit, and then I have all the different shells here. So you see here the shape is very different, the contributions from the different shells is very different. And the reason for this is when you're in this 1 over Q squared regime, you're really dominated by these low momentum transfer. Low momentum transfer means you need to be in low photoelectron bins to have a signal, and also low mass.
So in the event that you only have a few events, potentially qubits joined up, but
yeah, so it's the same. It's the same data.
This would become sensitive, a theoretical understanding of FDM.
Yeah, so you would have to make these plots for both models. Right, because you're asking how would I be able to differentiate if it was a light mediator or a heavy mediator. Through the data itself, you couldn't. It's the interpretation of the data that gives you that. So this is why I have to show the two different plots. Okay. Moving on. And then you can also do the same thing with Xenon 100. So last year, in May or so, the Xenon 100 collaboration put out their S2-only analysis after several years of prompting. This is the data in the green dots, which I then put into my into this form. These are basically the same thing. And I'm also showing the same two dark matter example dark matter masses here. And here you can really see that it's the low bins that set the limit for the low masses, whereas the heavier masses kind of span a larger range. The other point with xenon 10, now it's the conversion from photoelectrons to electrons is slightly different. One big thing to notice with the xenon 100 data is that their threshold was with 4 electrons, so it was 80 photoelectrons. So they don't have any, they didn't publish any data below 80 photoelectrons, so below 4 electrons. And you'll see in the next slide how this affects the limits.
Why does Xenon 100 have lots more background events with lots of photoelectrons than Xenon 10 did? Like on the Xenon 10 thing, you had the yellow bars.
Yeah, they stopped much.
They stopped much.
Yeah, so they just showed, they gave more of the data.
Okay,
for the S2 only analysis. So they present the number of events they observe in some range of photoelectrons.
Okay, but if you go back to the Xenon 10, it's like, so there's a large number of photoelectrons, xenon 10 seems to see very few events.
Yeah, so yeah, there's
no,
so
on the left, on the left hand.
Yeah,
bars.
But so these yellow bars are this cluster of events.
Yeah.
And so this is just a histogram of these.
Oh sure. There are very few events with large numbers of photoelectrons. Whereas xenon 100 seems to see lots of events with.
Yeah. Oh, I guess part of the point is xenon 100 was much bigger detector.
So it's just a size thing. Yeah,
it's a size thing.
Yes. No, but it seems flatter, right? The xenon 100 thing is flat. This drops off basically.
I think if you had the same exposure, it would be.
Okay, that's weird.
I mean, because you start to, if you had higher exposure, then okay, these bins would start to populate, but then you would start to populate because this is one, right?
Yeah,
because
it was a little truncated. Right?
This is one. So if you see one more, then you would see.
That's actually one. Yeah,
yeah.
You missed that one.
Yeah, it's just small statistics here. Okay, yeah, and then here you have whatever, 2 × 365 more exposure. So you can do the same exercise here, and we get the line in red for the xenon 100 bounds. So I was saying earlier that the xenon 100 search had a threshold of 4 electrons. And you see this really clearly in the left-hand plot because it limits the mass reach that you can get. Right, because you require at least 4 electrons from your scattering, which means you need to have a certain amount of recoil energy imparted. So because you have this 4 electron versus 1 electron threshold, xenon 100 can't go down lower in mass. But you can see where they do overlap. Xenon 100 and xenon 10 are comparable. It's really evident in the light meteor case, because here I was saying you are really dominated by the low Q, low momentum events. And when you have this higher threshold, you cut out those events. So the xenon 100 is much weaker than the xenon 10 in this case. Okay. So in these plots, I'm just showing you the sigma e bar versus m chi with in terms of these form factors. So we can now put it in terms of an example model. So kind of a favorite model of the people that I work with, and I guess me as well as a result, is the hidden photon. So here is where you have an extra U1 gauge group. It gives you a hidden photon, which we call A prime, that then kinetically mixes with the regular photon. And so the way that the dark matter scatters off the electron is the dark matter talks to A prime through a G chi. The A prime kinetically mixes with the regular photon, and the regular photon talks to the electron. So this is the scattering diagram. And the reference cross-section can then be written in this form. Here are the two limits for heavy mediator, light mediator. And the form factor is written in this form. And you see in the two limits for a heavy mediator, goes like 1, whereas for a light mediator, it goes like 1 over q squared. Okay, so now here's a specific model. And so how do the xenon 10 and xenon 100 bounds look on this? So on the left-hand side, I'm showing you the model plane parameter space for the mediator being 3 times the dark matter mass. Okay. And so here's the xenon 10 and the xenon 100 bounds. In gray are other constraints from other kinds of experiments. So down here are beam dump experiments, where these are also direct searches for the dark photon. And on the right-hand side, these are the current direct detection, meaning the nuclear recoil experiments converted into this sigma E bar language, and also collider. And by collider, I mean Babar. So this line, the strongest bound here is from the Babar experiment, where they look for a single photon plus missing energy, where they assume that the missing energy is from the dark photon. So in this way, you can constrain this cross-section. The yellow line is if you have a model, a dark matter model, where your dark matter is a scalar that's mediated through the 8 prime, and it's produced through thermal freeze out. Okay, so this is the cross-section you would need to get the correct relic abundance.
Wimpish.
Huh?
This is the WIMP, right? Like Wimpish or...
I mean, if the WIMP was an MeV. Yeah. Yeah. So this is your standard thermal freeze out production.
A
dip? So this is where... I forget which meson. It's one of these mesons that get produced. The pi or the rho? The rho. I think this one is the rho.
Yeah.
So there's a new channel that opens up at this mass. So this dip will change depending on this ratio. I think it's at 1 GeV, and so this is 300 MeV.
But it ends up not directly like that.
Yeah. Maybe a bit higher.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think it shows up later. Oh, this orange line is if you have your dark matter is produced asymmetrically, and it's a fermion. So this would be the cross-section that you would need. And the point here is through asymmetric production means that the cross-section has to be larger than this value. So this is the target region you would reach. Whereas for this one, it's really this boundary. On the right-hand side, the same thing, but for the very light mediator. And we have, in the low masses, these astrophysical constraints. So from supernova cooling, this really constrains, it goes like this. So once you go below MeV or few kV, this bound becomes the strongest one. And then on the high mass side, current direct detection bounds are strong. But there's this whole middle ground, which currently has no constraints besides these direct detection bounds. So this is actually the kind of models where this dark matter electron scattering direct detection is really powerful, because here you don't have these beam dump collider constraints. And then the nice theoretical target region is this, I don't know what color, beige line, which is where you have a thermal freeze-in, where you have a very, very small coupling. Your dark matter is never in thermal equilibrium, but slowly gets populated through this freeze-in mechanism. Okay, so the point here is that here's the current constraints, but these are interesting theoretically interesting targets. So how can we reach them? Because the xenon doesn't quite get there yet. So why does xenon not get there? Well, there's two main reasons. The first reason is the electron energy. So the ionization energy in noble gases is about 10 eV. So for xenon, it's 12 eV. And this limits the mass, this sets the lower end of the mass reach. So to be able to go to lower masses, you need to decrease the amount of ionization energy you need. And the way to do this is look at a different material that has a smaller energy requirement. And for example, semiconductors. So these have ionization energies of order eV. This is a 10 times smaller. The thing that limits your cross-section reach is actually the number density. So in xenon, you have about 1.4 times 10 to the 22 atoms per centimeter cubed. Whereas in a semiconductor, like a silicon, you have almost 5 times as many targets. So this tells you kind of how low in the vertical direction you can go. So this is just to say, let's look at semiconductors now to try to get into this interesting regime. Okay, so there's been quite a lot of work actually done with these semiconductor targets. So here's the work I'll be talking about. But there's also been some other work on this. Here's a picture of the energy bands for silicon. So silicon is a semiconductor. And in the, so these are the energy levels you find in silicon. So in this orange pink region, these are the filled valence bands. So these are where the electrons live inside silicon. And then we have a band gap. So this is the ionization, minimum ionization energy for these electrons. And then we have these empty conduction bands up here. And some typical band gap energies are for germanium, it's 0.67, and silicon, it's 1.1 electron volts. And we have, I show also here a few scintillator targets, which are of higher band gaps, but are also interesting because, for example, germanium and silicon are already being used by the CDMS experiment. And sodium iodide is used, for example, in DAMA, and cesium iodide is used in KIM. So these, all of these materials, except for gallium arsenide, are already being used for direct detection experiments. And because of the work that we've been doing, now people are looking at gallium arsenide. Okay, so how does this work in semiconductors? So we have our electron that lives in the valence band. And then we have a dark matter that comes in and scatters off of that electron and bumps it up to the conduction bands. That leaves behind a hole. And then there are two options for this electron once it gets into the conduction band. One is you can apply an electric field or apply a voltage across your material and extract that electron. And this is what I call an ionization signal. The other thing that can happen if it's a scintillating material is the electron in the hole can recombine and you spit out a photon. And then you look for a scintillation signal. So here are two kind of orthogonal directions, depending on the material. Okay, and in the semiconductor case, this form factor becomes slightly more complicated because we can't use these Hartree-Fock methods. The reason for this is because the electrons in a solid are part of a complicated many-body system. And what this means is that the electron feels the effects of all its neighbors. So we can't make the approximation that it's an isolated atom. So instead, we have to get these electron wave functions, we have to do these more complicated numerical calculations. And the way that we do this is to use a code called Quantum Espresso, which I think is kind of a funny name. But this is an open source code that's very well used in the solid state community that uses density functional theory to calculate electronic structure. And so because this community doesn't think very much about dark matter scattering off of electrons, of course, Quantum Espresso a priori doesn't calculate the form factor. So what we can do, though, is that Quantum Espresso internally calculates the wave functions for the electrons in different materials. And so you can take these wave functions and create the form factors. And so we did this with something we call QE Dark. You can find many of the files and example notebooks on this webpage that calculates the form factors for dark matter electron, or for these transitions between different electron levels in a variety of solids. Okay, so.
Question. Yeah. I don't know, this pseudo potential term, is this literally they're packing together potentials that seem to give you wave functions that match the behavior of the semiconductor?
Effectively, so they don't model all the electrons, they only model the outermost electrons, and then everything else they put into a potential, right, as a potential, or like a core kind of thing. And this is what they call a pseudo potential. So what I'm showing here is a normalized rate for silicon. So this is the number of events you would expect to see per time per mass as a function of the number of quanta, so number of electrons you observe. And here is the electron conversion for two different masses, so for 1 GeV and 10 MeV, and three different form factors. So solid is for 1, and dotted is for 1 over Q squared. And for good measure, I put 1 over Q in the middle. So you can see, at least for silicon, there is this like monotonic decrease in the rate. And so here is a good time to talk about the thresholds that you need. So when I talk about the threshold of an experiment, what I mean is it's the number of events you would be able to see above a certain number of quanta. So for example, for 10 electrons, it means that you have access to events that live in these bins and higher. Okay? And that you can't see any of these events. For 5 electrons, okay, you can start to see more events. And then for one electron, it means you can access all of the events. And because, I mean, this is a log scale and this drops off pretty steeply, you get big gains in decreasing your threshold. And so you can see this through this plot. So here is the dark matter electron cross-section as a function of mass, again, with three different lines. So the blue line is the 10 electron threshold, red is 5 electron threshold, and green is the 1 electron threshold. Okay, so we see for the 10 electron threshold, you are comparable, not quite as strong, depending on the mass, to the xenon experiments. If you can get down to 5 electrons, one, you beat the xenon bounds by quite a lot, and you start to access some of these theoretically interesting regions.
This is assuming a background free.
This is assuming, this is for 1 kilogram a year, assuming you see 3 events, which is effectively background free. So this is, you can think of this as being the most optimistic, the best reach you could get for this exposure. So the point here is if there is a background, you wouldn't be able to get to as low of a cross-section. And then if you can get down to 1 electron threshold, in this heavy mediator case, you can access almost all of this interesting parameter space, and likewise for the light mediator case.
The xenon 10 Kubrick experiments use the S1 and S2 plane to cut out a lot of the background events.
In the WIMP things, yeah.
Here, is it clear that you'll be able to reject backgrounds at sort of that level?
So here, the question here is what are the backgrounds? And this is not completely known. I said I was going to talk about this and I didn't. So one of the main backgrounds, depending on who you ask, for single electrons is in these experiments I was saying you have a liquid and a gas phase and there's this interface. What can happen is your electron can get stuck in the interface, stays there for a little bit, and then is later released and produces a photoelectron signal. And this would mimic a dark matter scattering, even if it has nothing to do with it. And so So Peter Sorensen is someone on Lux. So he wrote a paper a couple of weeks ago trying to come up with a way to eliminate that, because he thinks that's the main background for these experiments. And he proposed a way to eliminate that background by applying some high electric field or something on it. But the point, like I think what you're asking is, that they have this signal background discrimination, but the backgrounds that they're worried about there are much higher energy than what we're concerned with. So it's a different set of backgrounds. They're less known in this energy range. But I think because of this work, then people have gotten more interested in understanding the backgrounds for these low energy events. Okay. So this 10 electron line is where the super CDMS high voltage threshold is. So this is kind of currently what these semiconductor experiments can access. But in principle, you want to be able to go down lower, but for example, super CDMS hasn't demonstrated that they can lower their threshold below 10 electrons. But we want to be able to go down. So the question is, can we get down to single or a few electron threshold? And the answer is yes. Because of this work, people have started thinking about it, and we started an experimental collaboration called SENSEI, which stands for Sub-Electron Noise Skipper CCD, experimental instrument. But notice CCD doesn't come into the acronym, but it's the most important part of the name. So SENSEI is a silicon CCD detector. So CCDs are these small silicon, wedges. And here are the experiments. So it's a collaboration between the theorists, which are in blue. So we were the ones who were on the semiconductor paper, and experimentalists both at Fermilab and LBNL. And it's primarily led by Javier Tiffenberg, who is, I think most of these people are on DAMIC. So DAMIC is another silicon CCD detector. And so because of this plot, they were wondering, what do we need to do to get our silicon CCD detectors down to single electron threshold? So Javier and company started thinking about this and created SENSEI, and they came up with a way to read out the signal such that you can eliminate all background effectively. So in these experiments, the main backgrounds are through readout noise, is how you read out your signal, and through dark currents, which is just thermal fluctuations. And so through SENSEI, they've eliminated the readout noise part of the picture. And so what SENSEI is going to be at Fermilab, so they've created 1 gram, so we have a 1 gram sample. And I think at the end of this month, it's going to go into the Minos Hall, and we can start taking data with 1 gram. And so this is Fermi Lab, and this is where.
So they've demonstrated in the lab what the readout noise is.
Yeah, so this is a, yeah, this plot. So this is a, an actual sample of the pixels that they have, where they shined light on it, and they count the number of charge in each pixel. And so here's the number of pixels that saw zero charge, the number of pixels that saw one charge, number of pixels that saw two charge. And the thing that you want to notice here is that the width of these lines don't overlap. So you can really distinguish between 0, 1, 2, 3, and it goes all the way to 50,000 or something. So I stopped at 4, but it goes all the way out. So it's really, really impressive that they can really count electrons from 0 to thousands. So we've demonstrated, or Javier has demonstrated, I didn't do anything here. Javier has demonstrated you can count single electrons. The problem, so you can count single electrons, but you can't get down to single electron threshold because of this other background I was talking about, which is the dark current. And so the dark current limits the threshold to 2 electrons. But this is already pretty good.
Can you eventually
use now? No, so the 2 electrons? No, because I think no, because the theoretical prediction for the dark current also limits you to 2 electrons.
I see. So it's
just. It really is a. Okay, but we'll take 2 electrons. I think we're happy with that. Okay, so with Sensei and 2 electrons, the goal is to have 100 grams, not just 1 gram, to have 100 grams. So on the left hand side, I'm showing you if you have an exposure, if you run Sensei with the full 100 grams and 2 electrons for 1 month, you can have a reach like this. So you can already beat all the xenon bounds. On the right-hand side, for the light meteor case, if you run Sensei for 1 minute, so you just turn it on, wait 1 minute, you could already beat the xenon 100 bounds, which is really pretty cool. And then if you run it for 1 day, you could have the strongest limits for this light meteor case.
If you go to a higher mass, like what would happen?
So these lines are just going to keep going up because here you're dominated by this 1 over m.
Sure.
Remember how the rate goes like 1 over mass. And then also, then in that case, the nuclear recoil experiments become much stronger. So it really is in this like kind of sweet spot between MAV and GEV that these experiments, that Sensei could do really, really well. And then if you run Sensei for a full year, then you can start to probe a lot of this interesting parameter space right here. And also for the light meteor case, you can get a lot of the Friesen line. So I guess here, okay, we have 1 gram, so now we need to find money to have 100 times as much. We'll see if that happens, but we're going to try very hard. And so this is something that could happen next year if you get the money to do it, because the fabrication is known. We know how to do it. The technology has been demonstrated. We just have to make it. So just for the Sensei itself, so if you don't include personnel, it's like 1.2 million. So I think I've been sitting in a lot of these FCC workshops, which is like 46 billion. But to me, 1.2 million sounds like nothing. And then if you include like salaries for scientists and stuff, it's less than 2 million. So we're talking about around $2 million.
There's no extra backgrounds or modes that comes from scaling it up, or that's
open. So it will. Yeah, I think if you start increasing the exposure, maybe by a factor of 10, then there'll be a few more backgrounds that show up. But at these, at this level, this 100 gram years, it's effectively a background-free experiment.
Is there a technical expertise went into getting readout noise?
So this is something I didn't realize. This is the stuff that's been done. Like in the 90s. So the technology is something called skipper. It's a skipper readout. So you read out the charge, the same charge many, many, many times. And I think in the past, like for Domic, the main limitation was it's like this low frequency noise that they called. So if you read up many times, you get rid of that low frequency noise. And so you effectively completely eliminate it. The problem is it takes some time to read out the signal, so we have to figure out ways to do it a bit faster. The other thing I learned that was really cool about this skipper CCD that they want to try to do is apparently you can look for Earth-like planets because they have very low luminosity. And so you want to be able to count single photons, single electrons from them. So in principle, there's an astronomer we've been talking to who's interested in seeing if you can use this for looking for new Earths. That's all I can tell you. I don't know any more information beyond that. But yeah, it's sort of cool. Okay, so that's Sensei. This is probably the thing I've been most excited about this year. Okay, so we've been talking. So here I'm saying we have a background-free experiment. In the xenon experiments, I was saying we took all the events as being signal. So if you assume all the events are signal and they see quite a lot of events, you can ask, oh, okay, what can we do with the signal to try to discriminate it from background? So one standard way of discriminating signal from background in direct detection is to look at annual modulation. How am I on time? Great, okay. Okay, so just to quickly recap, what is annual modulation? So we know our galaxy has a dark matter halo, which is this gray region, and that our sun is going around in the galaxy. So the dark matter in this halo is virialized, it's going at whatever directions. And the sun is going around the center of the galaxy. And through the motion of the sun through the galaxy, you create what looks like a dark matter wind in the opposite direction. So there's like dark matter hitting you in the face. And then the Earth is going around the sun, as we know. And depending on the relative motion of the Earth and the sun, you either have, for example, in June 2nd, you have a headwind because you're going into the dark matter wind, whereas in December, you have a tailwind. And what you would expect as a result is that the rate of dark matter scattering is higher in June than in December. So you would have some modulation in the number of events that you see. And so for example, for xenon, the fractional modulation, which is the rate at the max minus the rate at the min divided by the mean, goes from a few percent to tens of percent. So this is fairly sizable modulation. For example, with the nuclear scattering cases, they have modulations around 2%. So this is a bit higher than them. And then you can ask, okay, so I have this modulation. How can I discriminate my signal versus background? So we can create this significance measure, which is the amount of modulated signal divided by the square root of signal plus background. And if you set this quantity equal to 1.645, this gives you a limit at 90% confidence level on this. Okay, so here's the reach that you would have with 1,000 kilogram years and 90% confidence level if you assume that the background that you have is either from what the xenon 10 or xenon 100 experiments see now, just scaled up, because we don't have 1,000 kilogram year exposure. But we estimate that we're probably comparable to what you see now. And the point here is that you would get limits like this. So this is for an annual modulation search. You can start to probe a lot of this interesting freeze out, an asymmetric region. And then for freeze-in, because you need this low Q thing, the xenon 10-like experiment would start to probe a lot of the freeze-in range. Xenon 100, like, no, because you need to push your thresholds down lower.
There are other possible physical sources for annual modulation.
Yes, this is very true.
This is one of the problems with Dhamma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you could try to, I think like with the Dhamma, one idea they were saying is, oh, we can put it on the other hemisphere in the Earth to see if there's a difference. If everything's consistent, then maybe it's less seasonal because the seasons are opposite. The other thing you can do is look at the phase of the modulation, because there is a predicted phase for the dark matter, whereas there may be seasonal effects wouldn't have that. But yeah, that's a true point.
The time has been rather ruled out.
Yeah, so I didn't want to mention Dhamma. but I guess they're the most famous annual modulation signal. So I think that proves your point that even if you see a very strong annual modulation, that doesn't mean you found dark matter.
Right.
You need to have cross-checks with it. So even if you see something in these experiments, you also would not claim that you've seen dark matter. So yeah, this is a very fair point. Okay. So the bonus little thing I was going to talk about is some preliminary work that we've been doing. And this is to point out that in a solid, this form factor has some directional dependence. So when you calculate your form factors inside the crystal, the momentum is actually the three-dimensional momentum. And in fact, if you keep this directional information, you could have a potentially powerful signal discrimination, depending. So the point here is the scattering along a crystal, depending on which face you're hitting the crystal, will be different. And so the first thing that we looked at was, the first thing we looked at was silicon, because it's a well-known detector thing. It turns out silicon is too symmetric of a crystal. So silicon looks like this if it had the four or the atoms on the corners plus one in the face without these middle things. So it turns out that silicon is too symmetric, so we had to start looking at slightly less symmetric or less cubic atoms. So the next one we looked at was gallium arsenide, which is one of the scintillators we had looked at for a different project. And so what I'm showing here is the form factor for gallium arsenide in the z and y directions for different slices of x. And it also turned out that gallium arsenide was too symmetric, so we're going to scrap this. So we've made these plots, and we're not going to use them. But the point here is, like, if you're in this Q space, in this momentum space, you have a high probability of the transition, whereas out here you don't. So instead of gallium arsenide, we need something more funny shaped. And what you can do is look at gallium nitride. So I was trying to describe this at lunch. So it's like a hexagon and three layers plus pyramids on the side. So I think this is roughly. And here you start to see more of an effect. And so in these two plots, I'm showing you two different slices in the y versus z direction and the x versus y direction. You can see maybe the shapes are different. The hot spots are in different spots. So in principle, you can start to see, depending, I think this is probably coming from the vertical direction, and this one is from the side. That depending if you're coming from the top or bottom or the side, you'll have a different rate.
What do the colors mean? Those are densities of electrons?
So this is the density of the form factor, where the form factor is the initial and final electron wave function overlap. Yeah. No. I mean, maybe you can start to do something more fancy. Like right now, we're just doing the most simple idea, which is the rate is going to be different whether you're going this way or that way. So that's what I mean by directional dependent. I'm not saying, oh, the dark matter came from over there. Okay. So this is how would you actually potentially do this? So I was saying the rate is going to be different whether you come from the top or from the side. So one way to do that is, so this is the detector here. And if the Earth is rotating, so at 6 a.m., your detector would have the wind coming in on the side, the short side. Whereas at 6 p.m., it would be coming from the long side. So the idea here is, like, with a 12-hour period, you would have a difference in rate. And so what are the kind of rates you would see? So for gallium arsenide, I was saying it also was a slightly too symmetric of a crystal, so you would see sub-percent level modulation. So this is the time of day versus the amount of modulation you would see. And the blue is the gallium arsenide. The gallium nitride gets you down to a few percent modulation. So this is still very preliminary because we want to make sure it's actually a real effect and not just numerical artifacts. And this is for a dark matter of 100 MeV. So the lighter the dark matter, the stronger this effect will be. Okay, so.
Yeah. So why I didn't get the part? Why the lighter it is, the stronger it is?
Because here you need, if it's light, you need to have high momentum transfer, so you're sensitive to the tails of the velocity distribution. So then you're sensitive to differences in the velocity. Okay. Yeah, I'll stop there. So I hope in this talk I showed you that if you take current direct detection experiments like xenon and just do a slightly different analysis by looking at dark matter electron scattering, you can reach sub-GeV dark matter masses. So this was previously not very well explored parameter space, but because we haven't seen WIMPs. We haven't seen stuff at the LHC. It's worth looking at other options. The current constraints on dark matter electron scattering through direct detection are through the xenon S2 only analyses. But in the future, in the nearest future, hopefully, semiconductor targets like Sensei, which has demonstrated technology, will push those constraints down even further, or just see something, depending on how lucky we are. The other point is there's a sensitivity to the velocity tail of the dark matter. What this means is you can have a fairly large modulation rate. So when you have a lot of events, like what the xenon experiments see, you could start to do an annual modulation search analysis and have enough statistics to start to say something interesting. And the other thing that I ended on was with a crystal, so like gallium nitride, which doesn't exist as a dark matter detector yet, but maybe it will, is that you can start to look for directional detection by looking at a difference in rate depending on time of day. That's it.
I'm going to ask a question about the astrophysics.
Okay.
Which is the driving motivation for why we look for dark matter. If you get down to 100 MeV as dark matter particles, you get a whole dark matter.
So that's a good point. So you're worried about structure from, if the dark matter is too warm, so if it's too light, it washes out structure. But this is not until you get to KeV scales.
Mm-hmm.
KeV. So 3 KeV is the warm dark matter limit.
You see, WIMP is called the miracle WIMP. That's right. Running universe from the production. It fits the galaxy's clusters down the top. It all works out.
Yeah, it works. You can get similar
scalings
here. Because in the WIMP miracle, what matters is the ratio of the coupling versus the mass. It's not the individual ones. So here, if you decrease the mass, then you decrease the coupling of it. And you can also get...
So everything should work out.
Yeah, so that was the scalar freeze-out line I was showing. Would give you the same sub-GV miracle. I wouldn't call it a miracle, but...
So for the modulation that you were talking about, putting those better bounds with xenon type things, is that, and maybe it was this, but is that an analysis that you can do with existing data?
Yeah, in principle you can, so it won't be that strong because like xenon 100 has 30 kilogram years, but in principle I guess I should have shown it. You could take that xenon 100 line and just divide it by 30. Simple arithmetic. If you just move it up by a factor of 30, that would be the current.
Okay,
the current.
So you could actually set better constraints if you reanalyze the data.
I don't know if they would be better.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But it would be different because you're making different assumptions.
Okay.
Well.
If you've seen the background, it's
constant. Yeah, so this is assuming that the background is constant. But it doesn't have to be zero background.
Where can we expect semiconductor results?
So actually you can use the predecessor to Sensei is something called DAMIC, which is another silicon CCD detector. And they had 107 gram days of exposure. And you could already set limits with that. They're very weak. So the current DAMIC, I can't quite remember what the exposures are. They're still going to be weaker just because the exposures are so small. So Sensei, if it gets funded, you could start seeing things by next year or 2019. I think that's what got me so excited about Sensei. Is like it's a new experiment, but it's very feasible to do now because there's no new technology that needs to be created. You're not waiting to figure out how to do something. You've already figured out all the technology that you need. You just have to put it together. And then, of course, then there's other ideas that are a bit more futuristic that you can do. So you start with Sensei, and then you start working on these other things.
Any other questions? Thank you again.